Good afternoon. I'm calling this January 18th, 2023 meeting of the Tax Committee to order. First order of business is approving the minutes from January 18th, 2023. Vice Chair Norris, did you have a chance to review the minutes?
I did, Chair Gomez, and I move to approve the January 18th minutes.
Excellent. Is there any discussion to Vice Chair Norris's motion? I'm not seeing any. All those in favor of adopting the minutes as submitted, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Hearing no opposition, the motion carries. And the minutes for the January, it's the 17th? 18th. Okay. January 18th meeting are adopted. Okay, so welcome, everyone. Good to see you guys. We're doing another presentation. I know that we've kind of had a lot of this on the front end, and we're going to hear some bills next week, but today we're going to be hearing about the tax incidence study. There's a copy of the full study in everybody's binder, or I don't know what you call them. Also, Mr. McQuillan said that he'd received a few emails about getting hard copies of the tax expenditure budget, and so we're going to work. We'll get those printed out, and we'll probably get those to you guys next week. I find it really helpful to have a hard copy, so we'll be providing those to all of you. As I was chatting with Representative Davids before the meeting, I said I feel that this is your top tool for calling out the hypocrisy of Democrats and our belief in a progressive tax code, so I hope you're paying close attention over there. And we're also thrilled to be joined by Eric Willett, who is one of our brilliant tax researchers in the Department of Revenue. It's always great to have you in Tax Committee. Welcome. And so I'll just turn it over to you, and you can take it away.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Eric Willett. I'm the Director of Tax Research at the Department of Revenue. And I'm here to talk about the tax incidence study. But before I do that, I want to say a little bit about tax research and research at the Department of Revenue. So we provide a lot of products that you may find helpful throughout the session. As the chair mentioned, when you do hear bills, we produce the revenue estimates that you'll see that estimate what the change in tax is from proposed legislation. So you saw one of those when you passed federal conformity earlier in the session, and you'll see those again when you're hearing bills here in committee. There's actually two research teams at Revenue. The property tax research team, led by Nick Green, does the property tax and minerals revenue estimates. My shop does the estimates for all the other types of taxes. But that's all behind the scenes. You don't need to remember that. The revenue estimates will just magically appear for you when you hold your hearings. We also do estimates for draft legislation. So if you're working on an idea and you want to have a sense of the revenue impact prior to introducing it, We can and do work with members on proposed legislation, so you can scale and scope your proposal so it's what you want at the time of introduction. Members work through fiscal staff, Ms. Templin and Ms. Schill, to get revenue estimates, and we're happy to help with those. Another product of ours is the tax handbook that you should have received in the mail, a real handy guide that I understand people have been waving around here the last week. It's really just sort of the very high level what you need to know about all the taxes in our state and local tax code. So it's a good first reference for understanding what the rates are and what the base is for different taxes. And it's got a short legislative history of major changes as well. There's the tax expenditure budget, which the chair mentioned, and that is a catalog of all the special tax breaks in our state and local tax system. Tax expenditure as a concept is anything that reduces a tax for part of the population but not the entire population, gives special preference. That's a tax expenditure. So the tax expenditure budget is kind of a catalog of all of those. There's a new Tax Expenditure Review Commission that will be diving deeper into tax expenditures. We provide kind of the basic information, but that group is going to actually try to do qualitative review of, are these tax expenditures achieving the goal that was set out for them when they were enacted? And the next new tax expenditure budget will be out in November of 2024. The tax incidence study, which I'm going to talk about today, the one you have before you is a little bit old. It was completed 2 years ago. When the Tax Expenditure Review Commission was created, the law that did that also changed the schedule for these studies. So we won't do another tax incident study again until next session. So the data I'll be providing you is a little bit dated, but hopefully the presentation will help you understand the sorts of information that's in the report and how useful it can be. So when you get the new one in a year, you'll be able to look, find exactly what you're looking for. The property tax research team also produces the homestead property tax burden report, also known as the Voss report. And that'll be coming out sometime in the next several weeks. And that is an analysis of homestead tax burdens by income and by geography. And finally, we produce a ton of statistics that are on the public Department of Revenue website. So if you're looking for data on, you know, history or something like that, it's a good first place to look. And of course, you can always contact me with specific questions. So with that high level overview, let me talk about the tax incident study. So the tax incident study, the basic idea is trying to estimate who ultimately pays the burden of all the taxes that are imposed and collected for state and local government in Minnesota. That's relatively straightforward for some of our taxes. You know, when you pay your income taxes, you're paying the burden, you're bearing the burden of those income taxes. It gets a little bit less obvious when a business is collecting the tax, and someone else. Businesses don't ultimately pay taxes. Those taxes are a cost of doing business that's either passed along in higher prices, in lower profits, or in lower wages for the workers. So for the business, the taxes that are imposed on business, the tax incident study attempts to, through economic theory and data analysis, tries to estimate where the burden of those taxes ultimately fall. And I'll be going through some of that data in the next several minutes. Minnesota was a leader, a pioneer in tax incident studies when we first did one 25 some years ago. Many other states have done them off and on. Only a couple other states do them as a regular course of business because they are quite labor intensive. But ours has been a model for a lot of other states, and we often consult with other states about how to do this kind of work. So this study looks at the state and local tax system as a whole. It's taxes on businesses as well as taxes on individuals. It includes all Minnesota households, not just income tax filers, and it uses a very broad definition of income when determining what share of income people are paying in taxes. So I'm going to talk about those strengths really briefly, then I'm going to go through some of the real high-level results for 2018, which was the base year in the report we did 2 years ago, and then I'll also talk about some historical trends. And feel free to throw out questions as they come up. So we wanted this to be as comprehensive of a tax incident study as possible. It's not a government revenue incident study, though, so it does not include fees and charges. It only includes what we define as the taxes in the tax statutes in Minnesota statute. But it's, a lot of incident studies just look at the incidents of the income tax, but this goes beyond that. I'll show you the list of taxes in a bit. It's not just general fund taxes, it's also the taxes that are dedicated to special funds like your transportation taxes and your healthcare access taxes. And then we summarize it all so you can see what the total estimated total impact is on taxpayers at different income levels and different household types of all these taxes. But this doesn't include all the taxes that Minnesotans pay. It excludes taxes levied by other states. If you have income in another state, you may have to pay taxes to another state. Or if you're traveling and you pay sales taxes in another state. And it excludes federal taxes. Obviously, that's a big share of people's total tax burden. But the purpose of this report is to highlight the taxes that you all have the authority over. So it focuses on state and local taxes. So here's a list from largest to smallest of some of the major business taxes, the biggest ones being the property taxes that businesses pay, both the state general levy and the commercial, industrial, and utility taxes that are part of the local government property tax base. sales taxes and motor vehicle sales taxes paid by businesses, corporate franchise tax, and then they start getting pretty small after that. But in total, it's about, in 2018, was about $11.5 billion of taxes paid initially by businesses, not by individuals. And here's the list of the taxes on individuals. The individual income tax is by far the largest. The property taxes on, paid directly by individuals on their residential property comes next. Sales of motor vehicle sales taxes after that. And you can see on down the list for a total of $23 billion in 2018. So there's a long discussion in the report starting on page 97 about how we allocate taxes that are initially paid by businesses ultimately to individuals, either as consumers, as workers, wage earners, or as the owners of the capital. It's kind of complex and stuff, so I'm not going to try and go into great detail on it. But our assumptions are that, based on economic principles, that businesses, taxes that businesses pay, get passed along to consumers in the form of higher prices, to workers in the form of lower wages, or to the owners of capital in terms of lower profits or lower rates of return. And what that mix is for any tax depends a lot on a lot of different factors, including whether that particular tax is in Minnesota is higher than the average tax on capital across the country, because that determines whether there's a national pressure to that you can't react to in prices. It also assumes that it's the long-term impact of taxes. So in the initial, when a tax is changed or increased or whatever, how that's dealt with by business is different than the long-term impact, because economic changes take time to work through the economy. So this estimates what we think the sort of settle point is for what the how taxes are distributed to individuals.
Mr. Ouellette?
Yes.
Can I ask a quick question? I'm just wondering, when you're doing this analysis, if there's like a difference between sort of a local business and like a kind of larger multi-state operator kind of corporation, because I would assume that, you know, just like a smaller enterprise is going to be more sensitive to changes in tax, but, you know, a larger corporation that operates in all 50 states or maybe in many countries, it's like, you know, if you raise the, for example, the corporate franchise tax a percent in Minnesota, and it's like one little chunk of a business's, you know, activity, like that they're not going to be as sensitive, or as maybe it's about time, that kind of time dimension that you just discussed, that maybe they won't be as quick to pass that along to consumers, or just if you could speak a little bit about that.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee. One of the important things that we determine for each industry, for each sector in the economy, is their activity strictly local or is it interstate? Strictly local businesses like restaurants, where you're not competing with restaurants in other states, are more able to pass a tax increase on in the form of higher prices than a manufacturer who's selling goods across the country. A local Minnesota tax is hard to pass along nationally if you're competing nationally with other manufacturers in a national market. So that local versus interstate market is an important factor in determining how much of the burden ultimately falls on consumers versus owners of capital. So the other thing that we do is we estimate how much of taxes are exported ultimately, because there are people who travel into Minnesota who pay taxes. There are non-Minnesota residents who pay income taxes because they generate income here or they own income-generating property in Minnesota. And there's also owners of capital who don't live in Minnesota but own parts of the shares of businesses that are in Minnesota. So part of the burden paid by those corporations will be paid by shareholders who don't live in Minnesota. So those taxes are effectively exported to non-Minnesota residents. And in total, we estimated about 17% of all the state local taxes that are levied in Minnesota are ultimately borne by non-Minnesota residents, either people who own businesses in Minnesota but don't live in Minnesota, people who travel into Minnesota and pay taxes but then go home, or people who live in Wisconsin but work in Minnesota and generate income in Minnesota and that sort of thing.
Representative Robbins,
did you have a question? Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that comment. Do you have any breakdown of how that is allocated by tax, like how much of it the sales tax contributes to the export versus income tax, et cetera?
Yes, Madam Chair and members, if you look at the table on chapter 2, page 2.2, I think it is.
Is it enough?
Table 2.1 on page 24, you'll see the first column, the total column shows how much we collected in that tax. As it's imposed, how much of it is paid by individuals, businesses, and non-residents.
Ooh.
And then after shifting, which includes the business taxes flowing through to individuals, after all that happens, how much is ultimately borne by Minnesota residents versus non-residents. So that summarizes by tax type that distribution.
Representative Robbins? Great. Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Ouellette.
So another strength of this study is that it's not limited to income tax filers. We have a lot of information, data, private data at the department about income tax filers, but a lot of people pay taxes in Minnesota who don't have an obligation to file income taxes because their income is too low. So we expand the population by gathering income-related data from other state agencies to create as close as we can come to a population file that includes non-filers. We pick up people who file a property tax refund but not an income tax return. That adds about 8 or 9% of the total population. But then we also get information from other agencies about income sources that people have, such as transfer payments from the Department of Human Services, that allows us to build as close as we can come to a population file for all Minnesotans. And then we take a sample out of that to create the database that this report is based on.
Thank you. Representative Lee, did you have a question?
Yes, Madam Chair. Just because we're talking a little bit about folks who don't file income taxes, I had a question on, just what this report actually counts and what it doesn't. I wanted to go back to slide 5, where you mentioned that the report excludes federal taxes. But wanted to ask if you could tell us how you reconcile that sometimes, right, when you file income taxes, you get a deduction on your federal filing. And so, in many ways, right, like when you pay your taxes to Minnesota and you get a credit on your federal filing, not saying we shouldn't pay taxes to the federal government, can you explain how you count and account for that? Because, like you said, the report excludes the federal tax burden.
Mr. Ouellette.
Madam Chair and Representative, that's a great question. So the direct taxes we pay to the federal government are not included in this report. The value of being able to deduct your state taxes on the federal return, that interaction that you're talking about, isn't in the base data, but we do have a separate conversation in the report that estimates what the value of that is. It's a lot less powerful than it used to be. For those of you who've been around for a few years, when the federal government passed the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and we sort of conformed to the provisions of that, it significantly limited both the number of people who itemize and the amount of taxes that you can claim as an itemized deduction. So the value of that interaction is a lot smaller now than it used to be. And I can provide information about that change if that's of interest, but I don't have it at the ready. But I think the percent of filers who itemize now is maybe 6 or 8%, and it used to be 30% of filers.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Willett, just a follow-up to that. Now that you've mentioned this big tax cut big tax cuts for corporations, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about that bill. And I mean, I know in committee we've had some interest on cracking down on international tax sheltering. And so we talked a little bit about how our tax structure is regressive. And I'm curious if you would agree when you talk about foreign derived intangible income and all these other mechanisms that folks use to export their tax obligations to other places.
Mr. Ouellette.
Madam Chair and Representative, that was not something I prepared for today. you know, the most of those interactions are at the federal level, and that's not something that's contemplated in this report. I think I can say generally, though, that those sorts of tools are most frequently employed by businesses and by people with pass-through businesses. And those people, while there are people with pass-throughs at all levels of the income spectrum, the income from those entities is concentrated among the wealthiest. In terms of how that impacts their ultimate tax, you know, we assume that people take advantage of what's in the tax code that's to their benefit. So the fact that those provisions exist means that they're of a benefit to those people who are taking advantage of them.
Representative Lee.
Madam Chair, Mr. Ouellette, my apologies. I have a bias because I was a staffer when this bill passed. I just, you know, want to make the point that, you know, even though these tools were created by federal legislation, there are many entities in Minnesota that take advantage of some of these tools that, you know, we may or may not support continuing. And so thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lee and Mr. Ouellette. I just wanted to lift up something that you just said, because we did have a brief exchange yesterday about the mortgage interest deduction, and just that with the doubling of the standard deduction, which was an item that we conformed with as part of the TCJA, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which was like 2017, just that it really has diminished the number of Minnesotan tax filers who itemize their deductions down to that 6 to 8% level that Mr. Ouellette mentioned. And so what that means is that some of these things that sound really like, well, I pay a mortgage, so mortgage interest deduction, like, that sounds like a great thing. I must benefit from it. Well, since I'm not in the top 6 to 8% of income earners in Minnesota, I don't, and neither does, you know, 92 to 94% of our residents. So I guess I just wanted to, to highlight that point, because that was a big change. And I think for somebody with like my orientation toward tax policy, it won't be a surprise to say, like, for you to hear that I think a lot of the provisions in the TCJA were really, you know, to Representative Lee's point, this major slash in the corporate franchise rate at the federal level, there were just a lot of giveaways to the biggest corporations in the country, but there were some things that I think benefited working class people, and this is one of them. And so to me, because I do believe that we have an obligation, you know, to do the most good for the most people, that if you look at sort of benefits that used to go to 30% of people and now go to 6 to 8% of people, then we have to look at those expenditures, I think, with sort of a fresh eye toward kind of the overall, making our overall tax system more progressive while we protect revenue to make the investments that our people need us to make in our communities. And I'm sure Representative Davids has a response to that one.
Well, if you look on page 8, we find that business taxes, they're simply shifted forward to consumers and higher prices. They shift back to workers and lower wages borne by owners as lower profits. So the more you tax corporations, they just pass it on and becomes very regressive to the person that's trying to make a living. So when you tax businesses more, the poor and the middle class and the lower middle class really suffer, because it gets passed right down to them. So we can beat up on corporations all day long and say there's rich, evil corporations. That's fine. But we should probably know what we're talking about. Just a little bit here, that if you raise tax on corporations, it's very regressive and you're hurting the poor. And I'm not here to hurt the poor.
Thank you, Representative Davids. And that's a perfect example of what I was talking about at the beginning of this, how this is a tool for you to point out the hypocrisy of Democrats potentially. But I think that there is some unpacking that we need to
do. Well, Madam Chair, I didn't. I wasn't quite that aggressive.
You would never do that.
Never.
But, you know, I do think that there are, you know, to Representative Lee's point, we have some unpacking to do of some of these provisions in corporate tax that can help us, you know, get at kind of, you know, folks who move their profits overseas in order to avoid taxation and other, you know, sort of corporate provisions that may align more closely with what I think, you know, should be our shared values around implementing a tax system. Representative Lislegard.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And to that point, I believe that, you know, if business is successful, labor has an opportunity to provide and communities prosper. With that said, regarding this subject, you know, offshoring really bothers me. And I believe it was underneath President Trump, they got rid of it at a federal level. And we tried to at a state level, but we couldn't get it over the finish line to stop that loophole. And that's one of the things that, you know, even the Republicans at that level knew that it needed to be stopped, and they did. And we passed it out of the House, I believe, but it just didn't get it over last time. So I just wanted to make that point that we should never forget that the Republicans realized that that was not a good policy, and they corrected it.
Thank you, Chair Lislegard. Representative Davids.
And thank you, Madam Chair. My good friend, Representative Lislegard, said a word. It's an eight-letter word. It's called loophole. If it's legal, folks, it's not a loophole. If you don't like a deduction, try to get rid of it. But don't call it a loophole, because it's not a loophole. It's the law. It's legal. So we need to watch our terminology here. If we're saying, oh, they're getting a loophole, no. They're abiding by tax law is what they're doing.
Representative Lislegard.
I said good friend.
You you are a good friend, and I respect you. You know taxes very, very well, and I appreciate what you just said. And well, I'm conflicted on with $18 billion and actually how we got there with $12 billion being one time and only so much ongoing. And I know that some people think that we should reduce taxes and stuff like that, and that's, you know, I would agree in some aspect, but I would take what you just said, my dear friend, and I would say that then collectively, we as a body, both Democrat and Republican, should seriously consider closing that loophole this year.
Representative Davids.
How do you close something that's legal? You pass a law and you change it, but it's not a loophole because it's legal. A loophole, by definition, is something that is illegal.
Representative Lislegard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I think that we pass a law collectively, both Democrats and Republicans, and change that law this year so we don't have to use the word loophole.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't remember the exact amounts, but maybe our Department of Revenue. But when the tax reform came in at the federal level in 17, they replaced the interest standard mortgage interest deduction, all these different deductions, with a really high standard deduction. I think it's about 10 grand, right? I can't remember.
No, it's higher.
Is it higher? Okay. And can you could you just give us a little quick synopsis? You probably know better than I can recall as to what the standard deduction was before, and then that was piggybacked with mortgage interest and some other federal deductions that you could take, and instead that all went away, and you have this higher standard deduction. What those numbers are, please.
Mr. Ouellette, if you would like, we can certainly turn probably to our fiscal staff or one of our nonpartisan researchers, but it's up to you. Should we phone an assist here? Looks like we're having some shuffling among our researchers up here, so we'll assume they're taking care of it. Mr. Williams.
Chair Gomez and Representative Anderson, around the time that TCJA sort of at the federal level increased the standard deduction and removed personal and dependent exemptions, the standard deduction was around $13,000, and it was approximately doubled to about $24,000. Those numbers are indexed for inflation, and so I think in Minnesota eventually adopted the federal amounts in state law, and so those are sort of ongoing in Minnesota. I think that for tax year 2013, the number I saw was around, and the numbers I'm setting here are for married couples filing joint returns, so it's half as much for single filers. Mm-hmm. I think for tax year 23, the standard deduction for Minnesota purposes is around $27,000. I think it's $27,300, if I remember exactly.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to remind me, too, Mr. Williams, before you leave too soon, isn't that one of the ones a lot of the individual tax breaks in the TCJA were expiring, where the ones for corporations were continuing on into perpetuity?
Mr. Williams.
Chair Marquardt and Representative Joachim. With it.
You said Chair Marquardt.
Oh, excuse me, sorry.
Oh, God. Old habits die hard.
Chair Gomez, I was clearly thinking back to the good old days of 2018.
Of the TCJA, I know, right?
As Chair or Representative Joachim mentioned, there were several provisions in the TCJA for individuals that were expired temporary. Many of the provisions for C corporations in the federally were permanent. The standard deduction federally is a temporary provision. And so under federal law, sort of in 2025, those provisions will expire and we'll kind of revert back to the old federal system of a smaller standard deduction, personal exemptions.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And just can you just talk about what will happen in Minnesota after 2025, though, as long as we're on the same line?
Chair Gomez, members, so in 2025, Minnesota sort of adopted the TCJA standard deduction amount, but we did so on a permanent basis. So that number is now coded into state law. So when the federal government changes, our standard deduction will stay the same. So we've sort of permanently removed personal exemptions from our tax calculation and kept our standard deduction at that higher level.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. I'm looking at Representative Davids. Did you realize we did that when we passed the tax bill? Or did you have any comment to add, Representative
Davids? I have a comment because I realize it because Kelly Canavati told me about it. So, thank you for that, by the way. Okay, so let me get this right, and I should just know this. I got to think through this a little bit. Okay, so in 2025, Minnesota stays the same at the 27.3 on inflation. Okay, so then on my federal returns, then do I get to start deducting all my, well, I do anyways because I itemize, but for, well, do you think there'll be more people shifting? I mean, we don't. A hypothetical to itemizing versus standard deduction.
Mr. Williams.
Chair Gomez and Representative Davids, I think that's likely. Sort of the federal treatment goes back to the pre-TCJA treatment when there was sort of the numbers that Mr. Willett was discussing earlier, where it's more like 60% of filers were claiming the standard deduction and versus now we're in the 90% range. And it's currently higher for Minnesota purposes than for federal purposes, because there's certain things that you can't deduct in, for Minnesota, like state taxes that you can deduct federally. So
then, Madam Chair, and Mr. Williams, how does that apply to the LOST then? I mean,
Mr. Williams.
Chair Gomez, Representative Davids, could you mention or clarify what you mean by that?
Local state taxes.
Salt.
Okay. Salt. Oh, laws. Right. I got. Oh no, that's local option sales taxes. Which was
just, we were like,
yeah, I was lost.
You want to come back up?
I was lost. Salt. That's a great movie with Angelina Jolie, by the way.
I actually love that movie too. It's very
salt.
Mr. Williams.
Chair Gomez, Representative Davids. So, for federal purposes, under the TCJA treatment, your total state and local tax deduction is capped at $10,000. For state purposes, after conforming to the TCJA and then ongoing after tax year 25, we also have a property taxes and a deduction for other taxes, and the property taxes portion is capped at $10,000. That state cap is permanent. And so the federal government, after 2025, will revert to the pre-TCJA treatment. So the SALT deduction will be uncapped. You'll be allowed to continue to deduct your state taxes on your federal return to an unlimited amount.
So I don't care if I call it lost or salt or whatever you want to call it. That's awesome. Yeah.
All right, we're going to...
I didn't realize that.
We're going to move on from Representative Davids' personal tax questions to Mr. Williams about his own return, I think.
Save me $2,000.
I know. I mean, free consulting here is part of many the many services that House Research provides. Okay, anybody else want to have a question or comment at this point? Representative Elkins.
Just real quick, Madam Chair, at some point I would like to kind of at least personally do a deeper dive into how we determine what portion of corporate profits is taxed. I know that's a very contentious issue, and I don't know if everybody here is interested in it, but I'd like to, if you have studies or things that I could read on my own, I'd like to understand that.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Elkins. I think that, Representative Anderson, we sort of had a conversation about that, I mean, in the last couple of weeks, about doing sort of asking for some more information about corporate tax. And I'm interested, certainly, you know, about kind of the as we look on page 8, about when you estimate how much of, for example, a corporate franchise tax is shifted to consumers to workers, and how much is borne by owners as lower profits, you know, and kind of like what's that mix, and maybe a little bit more detail on that. So maybe what we'll do is we'll kind of have an offline conversation about sort of the contours of what people are looking for in terms of a conversation about corporate tax, and then pass that over to our staff and get it moving and schedule it for a future time. I'm looking at Mr. Clayman. I know that's his... It's his area. Thumbs up. Okay, great. I also just want to mention, though, I did Google loophole because I was like, it doesn't necessarily refer to something illegal, and we do have to have a way to talk about tax avoidance strategies. I think, obviously, we know that, right? A lot of the you know, the offshoring, for example, that was what we were discussing, what Representative Lislegarde was discussing, and we know that it has been within the law at the federal level up until those base broadening provisions of the TCJA were implemented. But because something's within the law doesn't necessarily mean that we can't look at it and analyze it and talk about, you know, if there's a way to make it better, to your point, right? So I think that we do have to have a way if as you suggested, you know, if we have a problem with something, then we need then we have the power to change policy around it. But we do need to have a way to sort of discuss where we're at, and whether the terminology is loophole or it's a legal tax avoidance strategy or other term. You know, we've had a lot of conversations so far, even in this committee, about defining terms, which is fine. But you know, there is at some point where maybe not going to agree on the words that we use, but we do have to develop a shared understanding of how to do that analysis that can lead us to making the best policy for the people of Minnesota. And Representative Davids, you might have a...
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I was getting mixed up on lost. It's exactly what you said, though. It's an LTAS, legal tax avoidance strategy.
Oh, okay.
LTAS.
We're just going to increase the acronyms here. I think that will help that'll clarify everything for us, right?
Lost.
Representative Joy.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. One of the things, too, is on page 8, as you're bringing up the shifted forward to consumers and higher prices, shifted back to workers, lower wages, and borne by owners as lower profits. You know, as we continue that and we look at taxes and everything, again, in businesses, we're shifting it to the consumer when they go purchase it. On top of that, as we put higher taxes, of course, comes credit cards. Nobody really carries cash anymore, so credit cards. We have to think of that part, too, on the business owner. When 3% of the credit card is being taxed and we're putting it back to the consumer, that's where the inflation comes into the factor, because when it's dollar gas at 3% compared to $4 gas at 3%, that's another factor to be put into these two when we're talking about this. So I just want to make that.
Great. Thank you, Representative Joy, for bringing up that point. All right. I think we're back to you, Mr. Ouellette. Thank you for your patience with us.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So I was describing how we build the underlying database, but in essence, it is a sample of all Minnesota taxpayers, including those that don't file income tax. blown up to represent the entire population. So the sample is about 135,000 records, representing about 2.8 million taxpayers in for the 2018 part of the study. So the results that we show are divided into deciles. I think the information that your research staff provided to you last week was boiled down to five categories, but we have 10, so it's a little bit more complexity, but a little bit more granularity. But it's the same idea. Each represents 10% of the population. The first decile is the 10% with the lowest income. The top decile is the 10% with the highest income, and so on. And then we show additional detail for the top 5 and 1% in some of the tables. Just as a warning, what we count as a household is different than a census household. We're not talking about people who live together. We're talking about economic units that pay taxes together. So a married filing joint and dependents is one record. Two single individuals who are roommates sharing an apartment are two records for us. They would be one record for the census. So real quickly, the basis for this is two things: how much tax and how much income. We use a very broad definition of money income. So we include federal gross income, non-taxable Social Security and pension income, non-taxable interest income, workers' compensation, MFIP payments, voluntary contributions, deferred compensation. It doesn't include all income, however, but it is a very broad measure of income. It does include in-kind assistance like food stamps and housing assistance or fringe benefits or pre-tax payments for health insurance or medical care. So those monies are not kind of available as cash to pay your taxes. So we try to use sort of a what is the income stream that you can actually pay your taxes out of as the measure of income. So let me show you some of the high-level results. And again, these are for 2018. In the report, there's also a projection year, which was 2023 at the time we did this report. But those numbers are pretty dated because the 2018 was based on actual 2018 data. The 2023 was 2018 data blown up using the forecast at the time. And there's been law changes and a lot of economic changes like a pandemic since this was done. So I caution you to not put too much stock in the 2023 numbers in the report. But again, when we produce a new report, at the time it's released, I think both the base year and the projection year are useful and important. But I'm just going to talk about the 2018 results so that you get an idea of what sorts of information is in this report. So this is kind of the high level summary of all. You roll up all the taxes after we've distributed them to individuals and exporting. We take everyone's tax divided by their income, divide them into 10 deciles, lowest income to highest income. This is the share of income paid in all state and local taxes. I'm going to talk about the first decile in a minute because you need to take the first decile numbers with a grain of salt. But what you can see after the first decile is a relatively flat line of the percent of income paid in taxes, ranging from 12.5 to what's the lowest, 11.1. That's a pretty narrow band compared to most states that have a lot deeper slant that's usually regressive. Minnesota comes closer than most to having a progressive state local tax system, and I'll have some comparison charts in a minute. So when I use the term effective tax rate, it's that measure of all the taxes that I ultimately pay after the businesses' taxes that flow through to workers and owners of capital and consumers, divided by what my income is. Okay, so let me talk about the first decile, because I always caution people to think hard about what that means. The first decile is very interesting and kind of different for a number of reasons. There are some people in the first decile who are temporarily low income, returns with business losses, for example, where their reported income in that year may not reflect their long-term ability to pay. It certainly does in that year if they have very, very low income in that year. But that's just one thing to keep in mind, and that represents not a large number of them, about 7,500 of the 200,000 in the first decile. But if those households were removed, that first the effective tax rate would drop from that 28% down to 23%. So it has a meaningful impact on the results. Income is also understated in the sample in a number of ways. We don't include that that in-kind income that's really important to people at the in the first decile, your food stamps, your MFIP, and those sorts of things. So I think it's important, and we don't have a good way to sort of quantify what that would do to the effective tax rate, but that's something that we could explore. So we always say that it's meaningful that the first decile is higher and it's something to pay attention to, but the actual number is something that you should know that it's probably higher for most people, but that may not be a apples-to-apples comparison in terms of ability to what those taxes mean in terms of their ability to pay. For example, if I have very low cash income, but I have a lot of assistance for food and housing, then the cash that I have left over covers a smaller portion of consumption expenditures because those other things are paid for with in-kind income. Okay. So we talk about whether a tax is progressive or regressive, and the general definition of that is a progressive tax means the percent of the tax as a percent of income grows as income grows. A regressive tax, the percent of income paid in tax gets smaller as income grows. And we use a mathematical measure that you'll hear talked about called the Suits Index. Negative one is a perfectly regressive tax. That would be the entire tax is borne by the poorest person in the population. That would be negative one. That doesn't exist, but that's the theoretical. On the other extreme, if the entire burden of a tax was paid by the single richest person, that would have a Suits Index of plus one. Actual taxes fall between those two numbers, obviously. So what does the Suits Index mean? This is a visualization. So imagine lining up the entire population from the lowest income on the left to the highest income on the right. What percent of the total income is paid by that first person? It's pretty close to zero. What percent of all taxes is paid by the 10%? Is it higher than 10% of the taxes, or is it lower than 10% of the taxes? So if the line goes higher above 50% first, and then gradually gets back to the diagonal line, that's going to be a regressive tax. If it's the opposite, if the percentages start towards the bottom and then grow up to the top at the end, then that's a progressive tax. So the bigger share of the tax paid at the higher end, the more progressive the tax is as a share of income. This we refer to as the bubble chart in my team. This shows all the taxes, and it shows how much revenue they generate relative to each other and whether they're progressive or regressive. So on the right-hand side of the line is a progressive tax or tax policy. On the left-hand side of the line are regressive ones. The further away from the center, the more regressive or progressive. The bigger the bubble, the more revenue it generates. The income tax is by far our biggest tax. That's the big Jupiter at the top of the at the top. That is to the right of the line because it's a progressive tax. The higher your income, the higher percent of your income you're paying in income taxes. Tobacco taxes is our most regressive tax. It doesn't raise as much money, but it is very regressive. The lower income, the more likely you are to pay more of your income in cigarette taxes. Smoking incidence is higher at lower income ranges. And you can see the other taxes in between. The only two major taxes that are progressive in total are the income tax and the estate tax. The property tax refunds, which are sort of a feature of the property tax, are very progressive. And they make the property taxes less regressive when you add them on top. And I'll illustrate that in a minute. Okay. So by decile, as I mentioned, the personal income tax is very progressive. The percent of income paid in income taxes by the 10 deciles, you see it gets bigger the further to the right you get, the higher income groups. In the first two deciles, it's actually negative because of refundable credits. So the households that are in the first two deciles on net get money back from the income tax system rather than pay taxes in on net. So this is our largest and a very progressive tax. When you add on the other taxes, you can see that that progressivity begins to balance out. The state and local sales taxes are very regressive. Again, kind of setting the first decile aside with a grain of salt, you can see very regressive at the beginning, and they get a smaller share of income paid the higher up the income stream you go. Part of that feature is what sorts of consumption people make at lower income levels versus higher income levels, higher savings rates at higher income levels rather than spending. Part of it has to do with those business taxes that are passed on in terms of higher prices, lower wages, falling more heavily on lower income deciles. Residential property tax after the property tax refund, you can see is regressive, but it's not as regressive as the sales tax. Non-residential property taxes, again, the first decile is a bit of an anomaly, but then it's still regressive, but a little bit less so, certainly less so than the sales tax.
Mr. Ouellette, just going back to the bubble chart, can you just talk about the rental property tax and the homestead property tax? And I know that we kind of make assumptions about that percentage that's passed on to renters, and so it's sort of like less, it's less precise, right? But can you just talk about their relative positions on the chart and like why rental property taxes would be more regressive than homestead property taxes?
Madam Chair, I should be able to answer that off the top of my head, but I don't want to misspeak, so let me make sure I get a precise answer to
okay.
you in the committee.
No problem.
But I do know, I do remember that we do assume, we treat rental property as a business tax. The owners of the rental property pay the tax, and then how much of it is passed on to renters versus reductions in profits is treated like a business tax. So that's part of the answer, but
yeah.
But again, I'll want to make sure that I give you a clear and correct answer on that.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mr. Ouellette.
So let me zoom ahead. And then all of the taxes, which is a lot of the excise taxes, alcohol, cigarettes, tobacco, gambling, very regressive. And the numbers in parentheses on the chart show what the suits index is, which corresponds with where they are in the bubble chart, those different types of taxes. I thought I fixed that chart. I apologize. I noticed this in the version that I sent you, and I thought I fixed it, but I must have opened up the wrong version. But refundable income tax credits are a very, very progressive part of the tax system. The percent of income paid overall is only affected a little bit by refundable credits. I'm talking about the working family credit is the large one. The chart that you would be able to see, if I hadn't messed this up, would show that while it's only a tenth of a percent difference overall, it's a very big difference for the lower deciles, that working family credit really changes the ultimate percent of income tax paid at the lower deciles, going from a positive number to a negative number. And I'll get that chart to you, and I apologize for that. Similarly, this is it. So I must have added it rather than replaced it. So this is the chart that I meant to show you. So as you can see, without those credits, the working family credit, other refundable credits, even at the lower deciles, you'd have a positive share of income being paid in income tax. Because of those refundable credits, the overall amount becomes a negative, and people are getting money out of the income tax system on that.
Just so I think that we must have printed off the older version, so we don't have this particular chart in our packets. But
I will get it to you.
Okay, cool. But we can hopefully everybody can see it from the.
It is, yeah, it's on page
66. Page 66.
Page 66 of the report.
Great. Thank you.
I apologize for that.
No worries.
Done in a rush. Here's a similar chart for the impact of the property tax refund. Without the PTR as the top line, as the percent of income paid on residential property taxes, once you add the PTRs, you can see that line really dropping at the lower incomes. It drops a little bit at the higher incomes because of the targeting program, which is not income tested. But by and large, the big impact is at the lower deciles. So a very progressive feature of a mildly regressive tax, moderately regressive tax. And this shows the suits index for those individual policies, the working family credit, the dependent care credit, the K-12 credit, and the two prop tax refunds. These are 2018 numbers, so they're a little bit dated, but you can see a plus 7, 8, or 9 in the suits index is not something you see very much. These are very, very progressive parts of a broader tax policy. Okay, I'd like to just, we've been doing this report for a long time, so I thought it'd be useful to sort of show how Minnesota's tax system has evolved over time. There have been some methodological changes and data improvements over the years, but these numbers are generally comparable. This basically shows how the overall effective tax rate has changed in the last, I guess it's 30 years now. It's oscillated up and down with some major state policy changes and with economic changes, but it generally hovers around the 12% range. So it was growing in the early 90s. We had some significant tax cuts in the late 90s and early aughts. And then it grew again, or then it was relatively flat. And then we had some tax increases in the, 2013, 2014 that kind of bumped us back up again. It's not solely due to state tax policy, but those are big explainers for the major shifts over time. This also shows the suits index. We've used two different types of suits indexes over time. That's why there's two different bars. We use a more basic measure of the suits index in the early reports. We refined it. The full sample suits index is much more accurate. It's using each data point rather than summing them up and just using 10 data points. But you can see that the tax system is getting less regressive since 2006. Some of that has to do with economic changes that have caused changes in tax, but some of it has to do with tax policy changes as well. There was a large, very progressive income tax policy change in 2013 that took effect in 2014, the adding of the fourth tier. That was a big contributor to the change in the suits index. This is kind of a non sequitur, but we also track the local government share of state and local tax revenue. Unlike a lot of states, Minnesota has a very intertwined state and local finance system because of our heavy reliance on education aids and local government aids for cities and counties, and the state's control of local option sales taxes and sometimes levy limits on property taxes in this historical. So it's a useful thing to keep track of. This is one that has also oscillated over time, but hovers around the 30% share of all these taxes as being local government taxes rather than state taxes. I mentioned that we also in the report do a comparison to other states. Because of data availability, it's a much more crude measure, but it follows roughly the same methodology that we use. And what it generally shows, I'll just kind of cut to the quick. That Minnesota is one of the more progressive state and local tax systems. It's close to proportional. The suits index is getting close to zero, this first chart compares Minnesota to some of the most regressive states just to show the big difference. These are generally states that don't have a graduated income tax. They generally rely heavily on consumption taxes. And you can see how steep the slope down is for the percent of income paid in state and local taxes for Washington, Texas, and Florida, and their suits index being in the negative 2.5 range compared to Minnesota, which came out as actually slightly progressive in this crude measure where we did the comparison. We also compared Minnesota to our neighbors on the next chart. Again, Minnesota is pretty flat. Some of our neighbors are close to I have very low regressivity like Iowa and Wisconsin. You get a little bit more regressivity with North Dakota and South Dakota. And I think in the report there's a table with all 50 states. Just at a real high level, just to let you know what else is in here, but I'm not going to take the time to walk through it all. There's a section of the report starting on page 76 where we look at different types of households and what their tax burden is by decile based on whether you're single or married, whether you have children or not, whether you're senior or not, whether you're a homeowner or a renter. So if those sorts of demographic differences are interesting to you, you can find those a little bit further in the report. And just to illustrate how important that is, this table just simply shows the median income for six different groups. Married with children, married with no children, married seniors, single parents, single seniors, single not seniors. And you can see, now this is the median, so this is the middle. There's people above and below it. But married status is a very big indicator of income. And generally, at least in the middle and around the middle, married couples have a lot higher income on average than single people do. We have a very high worker participation rate in Minnesota, so we have a lot of two-income households compared to other states, so you wouldn't necessarily find this big of a difference in other states, but it is a significant factor when you look at how the tax burdens differ from different types of households in this report.
Mr. Willett, I'm just wondering, is this an area where it would be possible to do this kind of analysis by race and ethnicity, or is that, would that be something that, because we don't collect race and ethnicity data related to tax forms, that it wouldn't be feasible to do that kind of analysis?
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, we do not collect race data on the tax forms or in any other data that we collect in Minnesota. We have been having some really high-level tentative conversations about what it would take to do that sort of analysis. But it's all in the exploratory stages, and we're not going to do anything before, you know, we talk about it. But there really aren't good reliable sources of race data that we could match to tax data for the whole population, and it's, you know, so we can't do that at this time. We've talked about, you know, the advantages and disadvantages of doing some analysis like that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Willett. Representative Swidzinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a question, Mr. Willett. In the income and tax estimates by domicile, kind of within that spectrum, do you separate out, you know, as a percentage, you know, so kind of just general tax, but also potentially in the areas of sin tax, so like say the tax that's estimated for cigarette use or, you know, other types of those consumable tax preference.
Mr. Willett.
Yep, Madam Chair and Representative, there is a section in the report that goes tax by tax with those decile things. So you can see each individual tax, what the regressivity is. In the household, different types of household section, I don't think we break it out by tax type. We have the capacity to do that. We have the detail in the database, but I don't think we've ever spit that data out and clean it up to a point where we could report on it.
Representative Swidzinski.
Thank you, Chair. Would you be able to pull that out, particularly, you know, in some domiciles with, you know, particular sin taxes or those kind of, in what kind of impact it has on some of those households?
Mr. Willett.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative, we certainly can. We don't know who's a smoker and who's not a smoker, so we have to make some assumptions about the share and then just spread it on all taxpayers. So there's some things where we kind of, for the purposes of this report, we spread it in the income ranges that we know are affected, but we don't select which households are smokers and which ones are not, that sort of thing. But that really impacts the total taxes paid by two identical households. One has smokers, one doesn't. So the average between the two isn't right for either of them.
You good, Representative? Okay. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But two questions. One is simple. Are all sales taxes, whether they're collected at the state or local level, handled the same way?
Mr. Willett.
Madam Chair, Representative, we do report local taxes separately. If you look at that table, they're down at the bottom. We generally use the same assumptions for distributing them, though. But they're localized, but we don't really have a geographic component in the database, so we don't differentiate geographically, because some people live where there are local sales taxes and some people don't.
Mm. Representative Elkins.
And then my second question, Madam Chair. I have actually read the this report before, and I use it as a reference. And one of the things that has eternally puzzled me, and if you go to page 131 in the report, we have a really steeply progressive rate schedule for the motor vehicle registration tax. If you've got an expensive new car, you might be paying $1,000, but after 10 years, it's down to like $35. And so I've never been able to figure out mathematically how it ends up being this flat.
Mr. Willett.
So, Madam Chair and Representative, that's a great observation. So there's kind of two things to think about. There's how much are you paying dollar-wise, but then how much are you paying as a percent of your income? So even if people in the upper deciles are buying more expensive cars and paying more, if their car is twice as expensive but their income is five times as expensive, it's going to be a regressive tax. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Anything further, Representative Elkins? Okay. Mr. Willett.
So just to wrap up, a few other things that are in the report. I mentioned that we do have a projection year. I would caution against putting too much reliability on the specificity of 2023 in this report, but we'll have a fresh report for you in a year with 2025 probably. We also have a section that shows the results by income decile rather than population decile. So instead of divvying up 10% of households by income, we divvy up 10% of income. So there's, instead of having a uniform number of people in each decile, we have a uniform amount of income in each decile.
Oh, okay.
So there's a few tables on page 56 to 61 that show those same results with that different way of distributing the population. The population deciles that we use for the bulk of the report give you a lot more detail at the lower income levels. The income deciles give you a lot more detail at the upper income levels.
Excellent. Mr. Willett, just Representative Davids had a question before.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And I thought you had a very interesting question just a little bit ago here about splitting things up with race. And I was somewhat horrified, terrified, mortified that the department's actually thinking about doing this. What happened to One Minnesota? What would you use race information for? Aren't we One Minnesota? We write a check for our taxes no matter what our race is. Why are you doing this?
I think that since I asked the question, maybe I can answer it instead of putting Mr. Willett on the spot like that, if that's okay with you.
That's fine.
Okay. I mean, I guess the reason that I'm curious is because we see disparate outcomes for people based on race and ethnicity in Minnesota. And, you know, whether you're looking at income, at wealth, at home ownership rates, you know, you see these persistent disparities in attainment based on race. And so, you know, some of that at least can be traced to historic policy decisions that were made by people who are in these seats or who are in seats at the federal level. And so, you know, to me, I do care about addressing those persistent racial disparities that we see in our state on basically every kind of quality of life indicator. And so that's the reason that I asked the question. And I think it's the reason that there is interest, not just in Minnesota, but across the country, in understanding the sort of dimensions of those disparities and what the implications might be for tax policy. And so that's why it's an interest of mine.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Anybody else? Mr. Willett, we'll let you finish up.
Thank you. So there's a lot of technical details in the report, a lot of discussion about how we make the sort of economic, how the allocations work from an economic theory perspective. So there's lots to dig into if you're interested. The next report will be released in a year. This chart shows that the comparison of population deciles to income deciles. The way we've been showing it, 10% of households in each decile means a bunch of income is kind of bunched into the last decile, whereas if you spread out and do income deciles, then you don't have many households in those top deciles, but you get a lot more detail on those upper income taxpayers. That concludes my prepared remarks, and I'm happy to answer any other questions.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Ouellette. I had one question, because you sort of, on our second slide here, third slide, talks about strengths of the study, of which there are many. And I'm wondering if you find, you know, are there any kind of weaknesses or drawbacks in this tool or things as, you know, because I certainly have used this as this report, I think, you know, early, especially, you know, when I first got on the tax committee, really have used it as a guide for the way that I think about taxes and tax policy. So as we're kind of moving through this, any pitfalls, any comments on that?
Madam Chair and members, thanks for making me end on what's wrong with my report.
Yeah, sorry.
it's a great question. So some context that's important to keep in mind when you're consuming this. This does not include fees and charges, which are a significant part of how government funds services. Conceptually, and data-wise, it would be a big challenge to add to the report, but it's an important thing to keep in mind when you're looking at this, that this is just taxes. It's not how we fund government in total. I wouldn't say this is a weakness, but I would say that, you know, the allocation of business taxes does require a lot of economic assumptions about business behavior, and nothing perfectly describes business behavior. So even if we're right on the whole, you know, businesses make decisions for a lot of different reasons, and there's no way we have it exactly right how taxes flow through to individuals, but we feel comfortable that we have a really good methodology that can be used for policy making, but I want to be, you know, clear that you know, how taxes actually flow through are decisions made by businesses all over, all the time, in real time.
Great. Thank you very much for that. Are there any other questions? I'm not seeing any. I just would add as a note that although revenue estimates do come from the Department of Revenue and from Mr. Ouellette and his incredible team, we still, when we're looking for revenue estimates, we work through our House fiscal staff, Ms. Templin and Ms. Schill, who will kind of make that connection for us, just so we're not all emailing Mr. Ouellette with our revenue estimate needs for our individual bills as they're moving forward.
Madam Chair, yes. Thanks for that. And one thing that I forgot to mention that's helpful for people to know about our shop and how it works is if you make a confidential request because you're working on a proposal, that stays in the tax research team. So the other people in the department do not learn what you're thinking, you know, what you're cooking. Kind of like those confidential fiscal notes that were put into law a little bit. We've had a long-standing practice of wanting to help you get your idea in shape before you introduce it without tipping your hand about what you're working on.
Yes, thank you so much for that note. There are tax doctors. They're keeping everything private, and I know that all of our nonpartisan staff take that just confidentiality piece very seriously. So I appreciate that note. Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Ouellette, with what you just said, so you're saying I can't call you and say, what is Gomez up to?
Mr. Ouellette.
Madam Chair, Representative
Gomez, sorry. Sure.
It would be lovely to hear from you, and you can ask.
All right. I'm not seeing any further discussion. Thank you so much, Mr. Ouellette, and thank you to the Department of Revenue for all of your work and for this great presentation today. Our next meeting will be next Tuesday, January 24th, right here in Room 5. And with that, we are adjourned.